This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Terry Malloy here to read The Week, the best of U.S. and international media. This is the April 19th, 2024 edition. All you need to know about everything that matters. On our cover this week, a picture of Netanyahu collateral damage. Will outrage over a deadly strike force Netanyahu to change his Gaza strategy? Main stories this week, Arizona's abortion bombshell. Briefing, the race for deep sea riches. And our talking points this week, changing the game for women. And we begin with one of the best columns in the international news, How They See Us. Israel bristles at U.S. ultimatum. After months of increasingly hostility and festering points of contention, the U.S.-Israel relationship is in peril, said Lazar Berman in the Times of Israel. The crisis came last week when Israel Defense Forces bombed a World Central Kitchen convoy in Gaza, killing 7 aid workers, including a U.S. citizen. In a tense 30-minute phone call, President Biden warned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that Israel must take concrete and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers in Gaza, or face a change in U.S. policy. Visibly angered, he ordered Netanyahu to pursue an immediate ceasefire. It was quite a turnaround from the president's unconditional support for Israel's right to defend itself after Hamas attackers killed 1,200 people and abducted over 200 more in Israel on October 7th. And it seemed almost personal. Rather than risk appearing anti-Israel, the Biden administration has instead taken aim at Netanyahu, trying to portray the prime minister as an unrepresentative of the Israelis at large. It won't work, said Attar Porat in YNetNews.com. Israelis are indeed sick of Netanyahu and his extreme right government, but they overwhelmingly support the war in Gaza, and they resent political interference by patronizing Americans. When Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called recently for Israelis to push out Netanyahu at an early election, even the prime minister's most bitter opponents denounced Schumer. Instead, Schumer and Biden act like they're like beloved uncles from America sent to save Israel from itself. But such paternalism doesn't weaken Netanyahu. It merely strengthens the narrative that he's the defender of Israel in the garden of its interests. What's particularly worrying, said Yair Altman in Now 14, is that Biden seems to be more concerned about Palestinian suffering and the political price he is paying for that than victory over Hamas. Biden's ultimatum gives Hamas a free pass, knowing the U.S. president insists on a ceasefire now. Hamas only hardened its positions, insisting that Israel remove all troops and empty its prisons of terrorists, including those who a short time ago murdered and raped our people. Israel cannot agree to that. If Hamas remains entrenched in Gaza, able to plan the next massacre, that will be bad for the Palestinians as well as for us. Yet, Netanyahu can't simply ignore the superpower that arms us, said Orly Azoulay in Zedioth, I'm sorry for the pronunciation of this. Israel could not have asked for a better friend in its hour of need than Joe Biden. But 6 months into the war, with an election looming, and the U.S. public opinion on the side of the suffering Palestinian civilians, the president needs the war finished. Biden has offered an agreement that would see Saudi Arabia open relations with Israel in exchange for a framework for a Palestinian state, in the West Bank and Gaza. Had Netanyahu accepted the offer and ended the bloodshed, it could have been his greatest hour. Instead, he has announced that he set a date to invade Rafah, the final remaining Hamas stronghold, where 1 million civilians are sheltering. Netanyahu is playing with fire, and Israel is the one who might get burned. In our briefing this week, treasure under the sea. Rich in precious minerals, the ocean floor may soon be open to deep sea mining. But at what cost? What's down there? A trove of metals and minerals needed for the green revolution to make electric vehicle batteries, solar panels, wind turbines, and for electronic devices such as cell phones. These elements include nickel, cobalt, copper, and manganese, are highly sought after among energy and manufacturing companies, and they abound in the deep ocean floor near the geothermal vents and in the crusts of underwater mountains. The most promising source, though, is the lumpy, potato-shaped rocks called polymetallic nodules, formed over millions of years by minerals building up on objects such as shell fragments or shark teeth. The nodules are thought to contain far more rare earth elements than exist in all land masses. The Clarion-Clipperton Zone, CCZ, a swath of the Pacific between Mexico and Hawaii that's about the size of the U.S., is estimated to hold over 21 billion metric tons of nodules, potentially worth trillions of dollars. We need those metals, said Peter Tom Jones, head of the Belgium's KU Leuven Institute of Sustainable Metals and Minerals, to make the transition to a less destructive system no longer based on fossil fuels. How would they be mined? The process is fairly simple. A support ship sends down a robotic harvester that scraps the top 5 inches of ocean floor and hovers above the nodules. The rocks are then cleaned of sediment, which is piped back into the ocean deep below the surface. So far, there have only been a few exploratory forays, including one by the Vancouver-based mining concern, The Metals Company, in 2022, that extracted more than 3,000 tons of nodules in just 2 months. Several countries, including Japan, South Korea, and Norway, have launched national programs to get ready to mine in their own coastal waters. But while most of the deposits lie in the international waters, there are no international regulations yet in place, thanks partly to intense opposition from environmentalists. What's the objection? Critics say the mining process would irreversibly harm delicate underwater ecosystems untouched for millions of years. The nodule beds abound with life, including sea worms, crustaceans, sponges, and corals, as well as many species not yet known to science. A study last year found 5,000 new species just in the seabed of the CCZ. In addition to destroying their immediate habitat, mining would send up great plumes of silt that could spread widely, smothering sea creatures further away. It would also disturb ocean floor microbes that consume carbon dioxide, possibly lessening the ocean's ability to capture and hold carbon long-term. Seabed ecosystems take millennia to establish and take seconds to destroy, said Australian marine scientist Tony Warby. We're playing with fire to think we can go down to the deep sea and strip mine it without massive repercussions. Who decides? Under the 1994 UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, Nations can freely exploit resources within 200 nautical miles of their own shores. Beyond that, though, jurisdiction falls to the International Seabed Authority, a UN-affiliated intergovernmental body with 168 member nations, not including the U.S. The ISA has issued about 30 permits to nations and contractors, like the Metals Company, to do exploratory mining in the CCZ and three other areas. It was due last July to issue regulations laying out whether and how deep sea mining can proceed. But it missed the deadline and now says the regulations, which will set ground rules for allowable noise, sediment disturbance, and other factors, may not be completed until next year. In the meantime, organized opposition to deep sea mining is building. Who opposes it? Last year, in the wake of a UN report that concluded the mining would be highly damaging to ocean ecosystems, 24 countries called for a moratorium until the environmental impacts are better understood, among them Britain, Spain, New Zealand, Canada, Ecuador, and Costa Rica. The Deep Sea Conservation Coalition, which encompasses more than 100 environmental groups, is fighting to stop undersea mining altogether. It argues that advances in battery technology, as well as new techniques for recycling battery elements, will soon cut down on the demand for newly mined metals. And tech giants Samsung and Google have backed a moratorium, while automakers such as BMW, Volvo, and Volkswagen have pledged not to use materials sourced from the sea. What is the argument for doing it? That the metals are vital to wean the world off fossil fuels. Demand for nickel is expected to increase 20-fold by 2040, manganese 8-fold. If these elements don't come from the ocean, they will be mined on land, which could be even more destructive. Land mining often causes displacement of indigenous communities and grievous ecological harm. Currently, the world's top nickel producer is Indonesia, which is clearing its rainforest in pursuit of more. Turning to the sea would be far less damaging, say proponents. Could also allow other countries to break into rare earths industry that has so far been dominated by China and Russia. We're not talking about mining all of the ocean. We're talking about one little patch, said the Metals Company CEO, Gerard Barron. If not this, then what? The U.S. gets left behind. The U.S. has no voice on the ISA as it crafts mining rules and can't be awarded exploration permits or mining licenses if and when they are granted. That's because the Senate never ratified the 1982 Law of the Sea Treaty that laid the foundation for the agency. Though Washington was key to negotiating the treaty, President Reagan declined to sign, saying it could undermine U.S. sovereignty on the high seas. Since then, conservative Republicans have remained opposed, and a 2012 push to ratify, backed by both business and environmental groups, failed after the Heritage Foundation fought it. Now, though, hundreds of former political, military, and security leaders are once again calling on the Senate to ratify the treaty with respect to deep seabed mining, said former Republican National Security official John Negroponte. China is eating our lunch. In our main stories this week, the turmoil in Arizona over the revived 1984 abortion ban. What happened? Arizona Supreme Court this week upheld a 160-year-old abortion ban threatening to upend the swing state's presidential and Senate races. In a 4-2 decision, the court ruled that without a federal right to abortion, the 1864 law could be enforced. It forbids abortion from the moment of conception, with an exception for life-threatening emergencies. After the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, state lawmakers on both sides of the issue sought to clarify whether the Civil War era ban superseded a 15-week ban enacted in 2022. A lower court ruled that it didn't, but the higher court disagreed. The ruling was placed on hold for 14 days and will go into effect after a 45-day wait. Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays said no one would be prosecuted under the draconian law. Republican Senate candidate Carrie Lake, who once backed the 1864 law, called it out of step with Arizonians. But Republicans in the state legislature blocked an effort to repeal it. The Arizona ruling came just a day after Trump tried to defang abortion as an election issue by saying he would leave abortion policy up to the states. "We have taken the abortion issue largely out of play," he wrote on social media. But following the Arizona decision, Trump said the ban went too far, predicting the state's Democratic governor would bring it back into reason. Trump's statements angered many of his allies on the religious right. "This cedes the national debate to the Democrats," said Susan B. Anthony, pro-life American President Marjorie Dannenfelser. What the columnist said: "Arizona is a warning," said Dahlia Lithwick and Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. "Its court resurrected a zombie ban, and national and anti-abortion activists hope to do the same with the 1873 Comstock Act, which outlawed transporting drugs or supplies used for abortion. Arizonians will vote on a constitutional amendment guaranteeing abortion rights in November so that this ruling could be short-lived. But the rights efforts to return to the Victorian age could be every state's future if Trump wins." So much for taking the issue of abortion out of play for the 2024 election, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. With its ruling, Arizona high courts managed to disprove Trump's claim and blow up his plans. Trump has tried to finesse his abortion stand because any national ban is broadly unpopular. But if Arizona's is any sign of what unfolds when abortion is left to the states, his efforts at damage control look very fragile. "Trump's stance is designed to look almost moderate," said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. "But his position is a strikingly conservative departure from mainstream thinking. Almost 2/3 of Americans support legal abortion in most cases. He knows Republicans are dangerously vulnerable on abortion and wants to neutralize the issue. But this is the man who gave the Supreme Court the majority that overturned Roe. If he's reelected, his allies will do everything in their power to ban abortion nationwide." In our best U.S. columns this week, "The Taliban's Gender Apartheid" by Melan Verveer, Karima Benoin, and Lena Tori John in the Washington Post. "The Taliban's treatment of women is nothing less than gender apartheid," said, and that's what we should call it, said Melanie Verveer, Karima Benomi, and Lena Tori John. "Since the Taliban took control of Afghanistan in 2021, women and girls have been deprived of all rights and largely erased from society. They can't travel without a male chaperone, get a divorce, or receive medical treatment from a male doctor. An Afghan woman dies in childbirth every 2 hours. Only 2 in 10 school-age girls attend classes, and many are forced into early marriage, becoming the property of husbands who can beat and sexually abuse them at will. Fewer than 7% work outside the home. Just like racial apartheid in South Africa, the Taliban's gender apartheid exists for the purpose of establishing domination of one group over another. The UN classes racial apartheid as a crime against humanity, and its member states should also codify gender apartheid as a crime against humanity. The Taliban's leaders have shown they crave international recognition and legitimacy. They must be clearly told that Afghanistan will remain a pariah state as long as it treats women like subhuman chattel. Sotomayor's Obligation to Liberalism by Mehdi Sahasan in The Guardian. Justice Sonia Sotomayor is the, quote, greatest liberal to sit on the Supreme Court in my adult lifetime, unquote, said Mehdi Hassan, but she needs to retire now. The court's first Latina justice has proven herself a bracing, cathartic, dissenting voice against its 6-justice conservative supermajority. But she should not repeat the catastrophic mistake made by another liberal fork hero, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. After being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2009, Ginsburg stubbornly resisted calls for her to step down. Ginsburg died in 2020, and President Donald Trump and a Republican-controlled Senate immediately installed the conservative Amy Coney Barrett in her place, enabling court conservatives to overturn Roe. Sotomayor, 70, has type 1 diabetes and travels with a medic. If Trump wins and she doesn't survive his term, he will replace her with a far-right Federalist Society apparatchik, and a 7-2 court will be even more aggressively radical. Even if Biden wins re-election, the GOP is expected to gain control of the Senate and will likely block him from replacing Sotomayor through 2028. It might seem callous to pressure Sotomayor to step down from a job she loves, but for her to risk her seat is nothing short of insane. Trans Kids Often Change Their Minds by Carol Markowitz in the New York Post. It is the big surge in transgenderism among kids largely a fad? Asked Carol Markowitz. That's the clear conclusion of a new study by the Netherlands University of Groningen of 2,700 children who were tracked from age 11 to 26. In early adolescence, 11% of the kids reported gender non-contentedness, wishing they could change genders. But the percentage who weren't happy with their gender steadily declined as the kids got older, and by 26 had declined to 4%. In other words, most grew out of it. That has major implications for the radical policy adopted by many American schools and medical institutions. Minors who declare themselves transgender need to be affirmed through puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones. Any parent or adult who objects to these medical interventions, which can cause permanent infertility and sexual dysfunction, is now deemed a transphobe or worse. The Dutch study found that of the kids with gender non-contentedness, most were girls with low self-esteem and depression. Many were struggling with same-sex attraction. Becoming a boy, these girls thought might fix them. The obvious takedown shouldn't be controversial. Don't let unhappy children make irreversible decisions. In our health and science this week, a spike in meningitis. Health officials are warning of a sudden rise in severe meningococcal disease. The Center for Disease Control says 422 cases of the bacterial infection that causes meningitis were reported last year, the most since 2014, and this year is on track to surge past that figure with 143 cases seen in just the past 2 weeks. Meningitis, an inflammation of membranes on the brain and spinal cord, is transmitted through prolonged close contact, such as kissing or living with an infected person. Even with treatment, 10 to 15% of patients die, and survivors can suffer deafness or amputations. Usually, babies, young adults, and elderly are most susceptible, but this outbreak is disproportionately affecting adults between ages 30 and 60, as well as Black people and those living with HIV. The government isn't recommending unusual precautions. CDC epidemiologist Lucy McNamara tells The Washington Post, but people should make sure they're up to date for meningococcal vaccinations. She also says to consult a doctor if meningitis symptoms occur, such as severe headache, fever, stiffness in the neck, or sensitivity to light. The Earth's rotation slowing. Climate change is now interfering with time itself, reports NBCNews.com. A new study has found that the melting of polar ice is shifting the concentration of Earth's mass, leaving less on the poles and causing more around the equator, which is causing the planet to spin at a very slightly slower rate. Lead author Duncan Agnew from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego, compares the effect to a figure skater spinning on ice. If she lowers her arms or stretches out her legs, she will slow down. This change is so significant that it's counteracting an opposite trend. For various reasons, including long-term geological shifts and fluid movement within the Earth's inner core, the planet has been spinning faster in recent decades. This temporary acceleration has led timekeepers to consider subtracting a leap second from coordinated universal time to keep it in sync with the Earth's rotation. But the melting polar ice, the study found, has delayed the need to do that until at least 2029. It's kind of impressive, says Agnew. We've done something that measurably changes how fast the Earth rotates. Well, that's it for this week. This is Terry Malloy wishing you all a great week ahead, and I will be back next Sunday to read the week.